Welcome to A Quiet Life. I'm your host, Ruth Amos. 1 Thessalonians 4 says, make it your ambition to lead a quiet life. In this podcast, I chat to all sorts of normal Christians, asking them just how they live their quiet lives and how they integrate their faith into their daily lives. I hope that by listening, you will be encouraged to go out and live your own quiet life to the glory of God. You can find the episode show notes, the Quiet Life blog, and other resources at ruthamos.com.au. That's ruthamos.com.au. Now let's get on with the show. Hello, welcome. I'm Ruth. It's so good to have you here with me today. This is episode 40 of A Quiet Life. And as I record this, it is Thursday, the 26th of September, 2019. And I'm recording early because I'm going on holidays for the next 2 weeks, which I'm very excited about. Holidays. What a strange idea. So I'm trying to get 3 podcasts all ready to go, up and going, 3 blog posts, all the bit this week, so that I can just put them up next week. And you can enjoy them, and I don't have to do anything about it because of the wonders of modern technology, which means that I can schedule things and they'll just turn up on the right day. So I look forward to that working. We shall see if it works. And you can look forward to hearing from me in a couple of weeks' time, where I'll sound obviously completely refreshed, happy, having had a wonderful holiday. Please God. So today's guest is Amber. And today's interview actually comes with a trigger warning. So there's a first time for everything, and this is my first ever trigger warning. Amber and I talk about mental illness. Amber shares about her struggles with mental illness, and she also shares about a suicide attempt. She's written some creative work around her mental illnesses, and she shared one of a short piece, creative nonfiction work that she had written about her suicide attempt. I think we get to the end of it, and I think from memory I say, oh, that was beautiful. And she says, really? I thought it was traumatic. And it was actually quite traumatic. I don't think I really meant beautiful. I think I meant powerful. Just amazing that she's willing to share that much with us so deeply. So I hope that this interview speaks deeply to you without traumatizing you. I hope that each of us who listen learn something about how we can support those with mental illness. And if you suffer from a mental illness yourself, I hope that you feel that you're not alone in what you're suffering, and feel that we're willing to talk about these things. It's important to talk about them and to get rid of the stigma, I think. So Amber talks about how her creative writing helps her to deal with her illnesses, and I think it's really wonderful to hear. So with that, because I don't really have any more news about my week that I didn't give you last week because I'm recording early, I'll just go and I'll let you listen to this interview with Amber. Today's guest is Amber, and Amber and I met at a panel at the Pilgrim Arts Festival down in Huonville, and she talked about her writing and how that helped her process her mental health issues that she might have. And so I thought what she said was really good, and so I asked if she'd come on the podcast, and she's been very brave.
Yeah. Don't feel brave.
you've done well. So very welcome, Amber. Thank you. We're going to start where we always start. And she's prepared, so this is wonderful. How did you become a Christian?
So when I was 15, I've always had asthma. So I had a very severe asthma attack and started to die. And then I went down the White Tunnel.
Oh, wow.
And I heard a voice, and it said, it's not your time to die. You must go back. There's something you must do. Now, I wasn't from a Christian family, so all I knew was that there was a God and that he'd reached out to me for some reason. I started going to various churches, and what usually happened was that at first they'd be really loving and forgiving and beautiful people, and then they'd start presenting me with a lot of rules. Rules were stuff like who to date, what books to read, what to wear, and I just didn't, felt too restrictive for me, and I didn't think it was for me, so I left. So then fast forward to the year 2000, ran into an old friend, and she'd changed dramatically. She'd been really quiet and sort of in on herself and depressed, and now she was all bubbly and enthusiastic. And I'm like, well, what's this about? And she'd grown in her Christian walk. So I agreed to come to church with her, and she said her testimony. I was very moved, and I refused to become a Christian. And I went back to the church another time, and they said, oh, Christianity's not really about rules. It's about a relationship with Jesus. So I'm like, okay, God, you know, all right, I give in. I'll become a Christian. So that was in 2001.
Yeah, nice. Cool. So we've talked about the fact that you have some mental health struggles.
Yeah.
What sort of mental health struggles do you have?
So I'm going to sort of describe it first. Yeah. So from a really young age, I had anxiety and depression. Really young, like probably primary school. Was able to live a relatively normal life until 2002. In 2002, I went psychotic, and my depression went extremely severe. And I was no longer able to function or work. So my main symptoms are a combination of depression and psychosis. So many different diagnoses, I don't think I'll go into them. So what usually happens is the depression comes first, and I start feeling so bad that my thinking becomes bad. And then the psychosis and the voices can start. They're very negative voices telling me I'm evil, telling me that I should harm myself. After each episode, I feel guilty and scared, guilty for burdening so many other people and lashing out at people, and scared that I might actually hurt myself as well. So I was in hospital pretty much all the time from 2009 and sorry from 2003 to 2009, but I stabilized from 2010 until 2017, and I was able to work and do some mental health advocacy, and I also did some qualifications in mental health at TAFE to help other people. But then after a very short marriage, everything went bad for the last 2 years. So I've been extremely unwell, since 2017. I'm hopeful that I'll stabilise again, getting some NDIS support and extra psychologists, extra psychiatrist. So hopefully that, you know, it just takes so long for those supports to sort of be there. But I'm hoping with that extra support, I'll start to improve again.
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, we're getting better at mental health. I think we're getting better at understanding it, and we're getting a bit better at dealing with it. But I know you've suffered a bit with a bit of stigma and stuff. So what sort of...
Yeah, I think we're getting better at some illnesses, but the severe end,
yeah, that's a good point.
So I mean, yeah, where people get scared of psychosis, but look at the stigma. So I see, yeah, I think depression, like when I have depression that's not psychotic, people are more understanding. But when they realize that it's not just depression, that I've actually got psychosis, then
Well, I think all of us suffer a little, you know, we have down days and whatever, so we can probably relate better to that. But when you get to psychosis,
it's just we don't understand it. And the other thing is that there's been a lot of awareness around depression. There hasn't really been a lot of awareness around psychosis.
No, you don't hear about that much at all.
No.
Yeah, so what sort of stereotypes and stigmas have we had?
One time I went to the Royal, the hospital, and it was with a friend, and she was having heart palpitations. We're both on a strong antipsychotic, which can cause heart palpitations. So I said to the nurse, we're both on this medication. And then I said to the nurse, oh, do you know my sister? She's a doctor at this hospital. And the nurse looked at me, and she was so shocked. And she was like, your sister's a doctor and you've got schizophrenia. Are you the black sheep of the family? And that was from a mental health nurse.
Wow.
And then the flip side of that is it's like, well, you're obviously intelligent and articulate, therefore you don't need any help.
Mm.
You're obviously able to manage.
Yeah, so I guess because it's a brain, we expect, yes, that if you're intelligent, or, you know,
yeah,
we expect your brain to either completely work or completely not work.
No, that's
but that's
right.
Not the way it works at all,
no,
is it?
No.
No. Right, yeah. So that would be quite hard to deal with, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I think, you know, like, I'm writing my memoir, and part of that is so that people can understand,
mm,
and so they can know what to do,
mm,
and so they're less frightened. There are times to be frightened if someone's self-harming. I think it's fine, that, but not generally. Yeah.
Well, I guess, like, with your asthma, as a general thing, you're good and you keep it under control, and then if you're having a severe asthma attack, that's the time to step in and do the...
Yeah.
You know, the emergency care, and it's...
That's right, yeah.
Very
it's the
similar
same.
To that, yeah.
Except that, well, I went to hospital a couple of months ago with an asthma attack. I was treated like royalty. They were so respectful and compassionate. Go in there and you're feeling suicidal, and they are horrible. They mm. often send you home saying you're not suicidal enough, or they tell you that you're manipulating them.
Yeah, yeah.
Or misbehaving, or...
Yeah,
that it's a choice that you're making rationally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we've got a long way to go.
Mm. Mm.
So we have friends who are dealing with a mental illness of some sort. How do you think we can best help them?
So I've got some stuff written down. So where's my mouse gone? There we go. So I think, as I said, with the, you know, when people... suffering from an asthma attack, respect and compassion are the things that are needed. And also look at people as individuals. Just because someone has a certain diagnosis doesn't mean anything much about their personality.
Mm.
So, you know, someone might be, you know, really sporty and they've got psychotic illness. Someone might be, you know, more into writing like me. Someone might... like gardening, someone be intelligent, what's another person's creative, you know.
So it's a case of let's look at you as a whole individual,
yeah,
and say, right, what's, you know, what are your hobbies and interests? Let's meet
what
on
are
that
your
level.
Strengths as,
yeah,
well, your,
yeah,
character strengths as well. Like,
yeah,
you know, is someone a good listener? You know,
mm,
yeah, we're all people, and except if you're, you know, if it's life threatening, just approach the people as people.
Mm.
The other thing is that when there is a crisis, like if someone's about to self-harm or whatever, mm, I would then, you know, get them to hospital, call
mm.
the ambulance.
Mm.
Yeah. Don't let yourself try and do that yourself, you know. Like,
right, yeah,
some people like try and try it. Take the knife themselves, or, you know, confiscate. No,
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 right.
This is, that's not what to do. Also, don't tell people that voices are not real, because it's like, yeah, they're real to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah,
they're part of my experience. You can be just as traumatized by voices as you can by real events.
Yeah, for sure. Because it's your brain that's processing this. So in the same,
yeah,
way that it processes the real events.
The other thing I'd like to just add is when someone's well, and if they have a support worker or a psychologist, they can do it with them, write down what, you know, get them to write down what helps,
mm,
so that when they are in crisis, you, or just not even crisis, just a little bit unwell, you know what to do.
Mm.
Like, different things work for different people.
So what you're saying there, I think, is have the conversation as well. Don't be scared to say, well, okay, I know you're suffering with this mental illness. How's the best way to help you out?
Yeah,
that?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But also do that when they're well.
When they're well, yeah.
As well.
Because I think when people are well, we try to say, okay, well, let's pretend this thing doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Whereas maybe it's better to say, we,
yeah,
know this exists. We know you're well at the moment. How do we deal with it when you're
it's
not?
It's the same as having an asthma plan, you know.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, when your asthma's mild, you do the, you know. I mean, it's more complicated, but it's the same process. I mean, and some things, I don't expect people to be a psychologist, you know. Some stuff people have done is cooked a meal, mm-hmm. you know, that's nice. Pray with you, because often I can't pray, mm. read the Bible. Sometimes little gifts, just loving me, mm. just saying I love you, and so does God, and so does the cat, or, you know, whoever.
Mm.
Yeah. But, I mean, it does depend on the person, and people with a psychotic illness are not all the same at all.
No.
Just as different as, you know, I don't know, people who are Christians or...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can't just put you all in a bucket.
Yeah.
I remember I had a friend who was having a psychotic breakdown, and yeah. And I didn't recognise it.
Yeah.
And she kept telling me she was going to be fine, and we sort of didn't know where to go from there. So afterwards, looking back on it, I thought, oh, God, we should have brought her to our house, or, you know, or brought her to the hospital, as you say, called an ambulance. Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, I guess that's just a case of we need more education in that sort of thing.
Yeah, and you need to sort of establish a relationship and a rapport with someone, and then,
mm-hmm.
yeah, yeah, sort of say what sort of things help you, even if... So it's harder when they're in the denial.
Mm.
It's hard, much harder. But yeah. it's the same process, but it's just harder.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've never, well, I guess I've been in denial, yeah. Yeah. But, yeah, I don't think I am at the moment. Might be wrong.
You know. It's, but it's just like any other chronic illness, I guess. It's a daily walk, and you just take it day by day and... Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
So you've used creative writing to help you with your illness. So you want to tell us how that's helped?
So when I'm really unwell, like when I'm at crisis point, it doesn't help to write. I can't write. I can't even think.
Mm.
You know, so I don't do that. I am writing about my illness in a memoir. And I'm studying creative writing through Tabor Adelaide. She's a Christian uni in Adelaide.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, that is, yes. So it's a subject I'm writing about to help people know what to do, to help people feel less alone if they're going through it. And I also have done a lot of political advocacy and stuff. I want sort of those in... powerful positions to know what to do too.
Mm, yeah, absolutely.
But on a personal level, writing makes me happy. So yeah.
Writing makes me happy too. That's why I do it. Just a better day when you write.
Oh, it's more than that. It's like I feel at one with God and with the universe, and that, like, this is what I'm meant to be doing.
Yeah.
You know, don't know why it took so long for me to realise that. So, you know, some of it is that I think maybe that, what's her name, that near-death experience is something I must do. I think it might be writing.
Because
I can't think of anything else, you know, that gives me such pleasure. And also that it's my greatest talent as well, you know. Yeah, reading and writing is probably my talent, and has been since I was three or four.
Yeah, that's going to be my next question. Have you always been writing, all through?
Yeah. So when I was in preschool, in kindergarten, I couldn't write, so I sat with the teacher aide and dictated stories to her and illustrated them. I refused to play. I wanted to be a writer. So,
nice. Yeah. So do you write other things? I mean, I know you're writing memoir at the moment. Have you written other...
Non-fiction? Poetry and journalism, mainly. Mm. Yeah. And non-fiction. Yeah, I have written fiction. But the main thing is I want to take fictional techniques and use them to tell a real story.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that because what I find is I love reading memoir, but some of them aren't very well written.
Yes.
You know, they're great stories, but... So that's why I'm doing the study and taking such a long time on my work, is so that it will be well-written as well as a good story.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. So can you share some of your writing with us?
Yeah, I'm going to share, but it is just for those who might be triggered, it does include, well, it is about a suicide attempt, and it does go into detail. So if you're going to be triggered by that, just shut off
now. Turn off now, yeah.
Yeah. There we go. I'll just read this out,
sure.
I think.
Yeah,
because like, you can't really paraphrase. No. All right. So it was the 15th of September 2004. I was half sitting, half lying on a cold, hard bed in the emergency department of the Alice Springs Hospital. The fluorescent lights bored into my already dilated eyes. I was struggling to breathe, and the nurses had to keep increasing my oxygen. The charcoal they gave me to drink tasted like chalk and stained my fingers and my face. The drip in my arm felt like being attached to a tap that won't turn off. But the worst thing was the heart monitor. It kept beating uncontrollably. I tried to convince myself that heart monitors always beep like that, but I knew deep down that wasn't true. People kept staring at me, staff mainly. They would walk up to me, stare for a while, and then walk back. I tried to calm myself by humming the tune to "The Wheels on the Bus Went Round and Round." It didn't really help much, but it was something to distract me. "Am I going to be okay?" I asked the nurse. "We'll do our very best for you," she answered. That wasn't the answer I was longing to hear. I wanted to know that everything was fine. Clearly it wasn't. The truth is, I had planned my death, the day, the hour, the method, cold-bloodedly like a stalker preparing to snare his victim. I had told my doctor that I needed to be on a higher dose of my antidepressants so that I had access to more tablets in which to do the damage. I wrote a detailed note to my family and included the phone numbers of the friends I wished to be informed of my death. I even bought my family a book called Surviving Suicide, which I hid under my bed. People often say that suicide is a selfish act, but even as I planned my demise, I still thought of loved ones. So what then was I thinking? According to the Black Dog website, there are many complex factors that contribute to suicide. They include things like trauma and mental illness. But that wasn't why I wanted to destroy myself. I attempted suicide because I felt so guilty. In fact, I felt so guilty that I thought my death would be a kind of freedom for my family. They had tried so hard to help me in so many ways. But despite this, I just kept getting worse. I became severely depressed and psychotic in 2002 while teaching in a local high school. Not only was I unable to work, I was even unable to cook or clean up after myself. To make matters worse, I had become romantically entangled with a very unstable young man. My dad, who is a psychologist, thought he could help me. So I moved from Hobart to Alice Springs to live with him, my stepmother, and my 10-year-old sister. They made sure I ate healthily and exercised. I was referred to a psychologist and a psychiatrist. And I tried hard at first. I took my medication and tried various strategies and techniques. Nothing worked. Eventually, my father told me that he could no longer cope with me. That triggered a huge red raw bundle of emotions, including guilt. Before I took the medication that almost killed me, I drank some beer. For some reason, having a beer helps me concentrate and relax. After that, I got out the 3 packets of antidepressants that I'd chosen to take. Each packet had 30 tablets in it, so I took 90 set tablets. It's hard to swallow that many tablets. By the time I had finished swallowing them, I felt so nauseous that it would have been impossible to take more. Then I made a phone call to my father. telling him to cancel his visit because I wasn't feeling up to it. My father, my stepmother, and my 10-year-old sister came around about half an hour later anyway. I guess they were worried about me. My little sister excitedly ran up the stairs to my room, calling out my name. When she got to me, I could barely walk. I saw her face turn from excitement to shock. I saw my father was really angry with me for exposing my sister to my attempt at self-murder. "You have traumatized your sister," he said in a voice so quiet it was almost strangled. I had been so consumed by my own problems that I had forgotten how I would affect this young girl, this sister, who I loved. As my stepmother drove me to the hospital, my sense of guilt became so strong I couldn't think of anything else. I wanted some tangible way to show that I was sorry, especially to my sister. It suddenly occurred to me that maybe my family didn't want me dead as I had supposed. In my psychotic mind, I had done it for them. I was all muddled up in the head. When my dad said he couldn't cope, my mind interpreted it as both colossal rejection and a lack of love. Then there were the voices saying I was evil. I'm lucky that I didn't attempt suicide in the Middle Ages. At that time, suicide was not only a sin, it was an unforgivable sin. The bodies of people who had completed suicide were dragged through the streets and none of them got a proper burial. This sort of attitude would have been so hard for the loved ones of that person. I'm also happy that my illness engulfed me in 2002. Because just before that, in Australia and in Tasmania, people with severe mental illnesses were institutionalised, sometimes for years. A lot of these asylums allowed for very little independence and freedom. I have heard it said that clients weren't even allowed to brush their teeth for themselves. Nowadays, there is the opposite problem. Often people who attempt suicide are sent home a few days later with a psychiatrist referral and no other support. Because of this, 10% of us are readmitted less than a month later. This creates what is called the revolving door, where we just move from crisis to crisis, and many of us succeed in killing ourselves. 10% of people with a diagnosis of schizophrenia, for example, complete suicide, compared to less than 1% of people without such a diagnosis. The night I tried to end my life was a long night, probably the longest night I had ever had. At one stage, I started feeling dizzy and the world was turning grey. "Keep her conscious," the doctor said, and increased the oxygen. After many terrifying hours, the doctors from the intensive care unit, the ICU, arrived. ICU is a ward where there are more doctors and nurses than on any other wards. I was relieved to be moved in some ways, as so many of the doctors and nurses I had been staring at me in shock. I asked again if I would be all right. You will require careful monitoring," they said. This again was not the answer I wanted to hear. On the way up to the ICU, the nurse turned away from me for a few seconds. "Why is the patient on a monitor?" the doctor yelled at her. The view in ICU wasn't particularly comforting either. All the other patients were hooked up to the same medical gadgetry that I was. Some had tubes down their throats and one man was obviously dead. I remember thinking to myself, this is a place where people die. This seemed to shock me out of the funk I'd been in for the last 2 years. I realised that I didn't really want to die. Not this way. Not in a ward, alone in a ward with sick people. Not by my own hand. I wanted life to be better, but I didn't want to die. "Going to fight," I thought to myself. Morning brought a team of doctors who announced she stabilised, as if I wasn't there. But I didn't care much, because, oh, the relief. They removed the catheter, the oxygen, the heart monitor, the drip, the blood pressure monitor and the pulse monitor. I felt an overwhelming sense of relief. I couldn't see properly and my heart was pounding, but I was out of danger. The afternoon brought an admission to the psychiatric ward and a visit from my family. I apologised and said that I wouldn't do it again. They were angry. You could have had a stroke and ended up in a wheelchair, my stepmother said. We're all angry with you, Dad echoed. You nearly died by your own hand. My sister distracted herself by running around. I would have cried, but I was too numb. According to Psychology Today, suicide is seldom the product of rational deliberation, but mostly an act of uncontrollable anguish and despair. In my case, this was partly true. I certainly felt uncontrollable emotions, but I had also deliberated. Maybe not in a rational way, but I had planned carefully anyway. This attempt on my life made me rethink everything. It was a complete shock. I realised there might be a way out of this, but I didn't know what that way was. And there are no easy answers to this conundrum. I needed medication and psychological support and lots of it. But I also needed hope and meaning. And part of that meaning involves writing this story. I hope that sharing what I went through will shed some light on what it's like for people in dark places. We need as a society to love those of us who are suicidal. Because we don't love ourselves. But we have the same needs as anyone else. We need love, we need hope, and we need meaning. I want people to understand what it's like for those of us who aren't coping. And in that understanding, be willing to reach out. Don't be afraid. Fear doesn't help. Love does. That's the end.
That's beautiful. Thank you very much.
Okay. It might be traumatic.
Yeah. It's deep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, traumatic as well, but...
It's traumatic for me. I felt like I was going to cry with my little sister.
Yeah.
That was that. That's the thing that makes me want to cry.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's a... I guess you were so turned in on yourself, you just didn't realise what was going to happen to others around. Yeah.
No, I didn't.
Hmm.
Yeah, I was so consumed by my own problems and my own thinking. Like, I would never have deliberately tried to hurt her.
No, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
And I still feel dreadful that I did, even though, you know, I think she's fine now.
Yeah, absolutely. Can you tell us, when do you feel close to God?
So I feel close to God when I write, even if I'm not writing specifically Christian things. Sometimes, weirdly, I also feel close to God after I come out of a psychotic episode. I'm not sure exactly why, but I think it's sort of God comforting me and me having the realisation that although I might be misunderstood by people, I won't be misunderstood by Jesus, that he understands and that he will be with me. So last year I was in hospital for 3 months and I read all 4 of the Gospels. And that was really comforting and striking as well with Jesus. It was like I was getting to know a close friend all over again who continued to surprise me and continue to love me because I often feel very unlovable. But, you know, I've got to keep reminding myself that God loves me.
Yeah, you know.
And I think my Christian friends also have helped me feel close to God various times, so they've always been generous, supportive, comforting. They'll pray with me when I can't pray. They'll look at comforting things in the Bible. they'll step in terms of my spiritual health when I am too unwell to do it myself.
Yeah, awesome.
Yeah.
It's what the body of Christ is for, isn't it?
Yeah. And as I said, also, you know, they do non-spiritual things as well, which are helpful.
Oh, I think there's something very spiritual about bringing somebody a meal when they need one.
yeah, that's right. You know,
what do they call it? Jesus with skin on.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So what's one thing about God or Christianity that you wish everyone knew?
So because we're talking about mental health, that's what I'm... This is something that really frustrates me. God can do whatever he wants, all right, and if he wants to heal people, he'll heal them.
Yeah.
But he doesn't always. Apostle Paul was not healed. Mm-hmm. I have not been healed. And not being healed is not necessarily because I'm demon-possessed or I don't have any faith.
No.
And, in fact, I would say that it takes more faith to continue as a Christian when you've got severe mental health problems going on than it does to be healed. I mean, I'd love it if I was healed. I'd be like, yeah, that, you know.
Yeah.
But that's not my story. It's not me that makes that decision.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, if people want to pray for my healing, great.
Thank you.
Thank you. Do it. But don't criticise me for not being healed.
Yeah, sure.
So what I find particularly comforting in Christianity is not the fact that it guarantees you an easy life, because my life is not easy, but the fact, again, that Jesus walks alongside me in my suffering and promises me a time in the afterlife when there'll be no suffering. So that's something comforting to look forward to, too, that this suffering, even if it goes for all my earthly life, won't go on into eternity.
Mm. Amen.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for sharing with us so deeply. Really appreciate it. Well, I'm sure that was a bit challenging for you. I think it was a challenging conversation, but a good one. And we all look forward to that time in the new heaven and the new earth where God will wipe away every tear from our eye. Next interview, next week, is with Professor Matt King, who is talking about living his faith in a university setting. He's a scientist, and it's a fascinating conversation. So I look forward to sharing that with you next week. I want to thank especially Catherine Joy from Joy Music House for the music and Matt Dobson for our transcription. And I just want to say, if you thought this could be helpful to a friend, feel free to share it. I would love for this to go to everybody who needs to hear it. And I will chat to you again next week.